I think we'll start. Just make sure you're in the right session. This is the Weight Watchers program. Is everyone? My name is Nelson Westreich, and I'm actually going to be speaking about the topic is, do I need professional help, or is my teen just being a teen? So is that the right session you signed up for? Okay. Around almost 2 months ago, I run the adolescent inpatient services at Sunnybrook Hospital. And I was upstairs on the ward, and I was running downstairs to my office, and I'm always late. I don't know if you've ever been to a psychiatrist, but I'm one who's notoriously late. And it's very, very late. And as I'm running through the hall, I run into a drug rep. Are you familiar with drug reps? Basically, their job is to carry around their items from physician's office to physician's office and sit in front of the office and see if they can get the attention of someone and tell you about the most newest and most miraculous medications. So this new drug rep approaches me as I'm already 20 minutes late, and he said, I have to talk to you. And I said, I really don't have the time. Why don't you make an appointment with my secretary? He says, no, I have to talk to you. I have to show you something. I said, look, you know, I don't have the time right now. He says, no, you've got to see this. And he shows me a brochure about a drug called Adderall XR. Does anyone know what that is? Adderall XR is a drug that's been used in the United States for the last 2 or 3 years. It's a psychostimulant, a drug used for children who have attention deficit disorder. But the drug, for whatever reason, had not come to Canada. And it was finally here, and this drug rep was very excited about the drug, and he wanted to show me that the medication had come. So I said, fine. So he gives me the specs, and I start to read it. And I said, look, I'll look at it later. He says, you know something, Neil? He says, I think you'll be interested in one particular line. He says, take a look at the bottom of the brochure. I look at the bottom of the brochure, and I look, he points to the non-medicinal ingredients for this medication. And I'm reading it, and it says, kosher gelatin. And I look again. It says, kosher gelatin. So I turned to the drug rep and I said, give me two of those, actually. I'd like to have that. I thought to myself, though, afterwards, how ironic. Here we have one of the largest pharmaceutical companies in the world marketing a drug for attention deficit disorder and felt that it was profitable, marketable, to add a non-medicinal ingredient and make sure that the gelatin was kosher. And I thought, how ironic. Kosher gelatin for so many Jewish kids who must be taking this medication, and yet it's not always so kosher to talk about the issues in our community. Do we have any children who have attention deficit disorder? Do we know any children who are on medications? Does it exist in our Jewish day school system? Do we have these kinds of problems? When do we have an open forum or an opportunity to talk about these kinds of things? And that's what I'd like to do this evening. You know, the rabbis have told us in the Talmud that there are three partners when it comes to the creation. There is mom, and there is dad, and there is the Ribbono Shel Olam, there's God. But the irony is that when the child is born, nobody hands you a manual about how to raise this child. There is no clear manual or guidebook to tell me how I'm going to deal with each stage of their lives. And all of a sudden, when they hit 13, 14, 15, or 16, I'm asking, where is that manual? Now, what I'd like to do today is to give you a little bit of a test. I promise you, nobody will flunk. This is a pretest, and I want you to take just a few moments. It's all true and false questions. And don't look at your neighbor, okay? And I want you to tell me what you think the answers are to this question. Yes? You're nervous? No, you didn't study. Okay. Here you go. Okay, so let's take a few moments to look at this pretest. And I think everybody has a pen in their kit. Extra? Don't Don't cheat. I see the doctors in the back are cheating. Good evening. Okay, the essay part will be coming later, and that's worth three quarters of the of your mark. Okay, has everybody finished the exam? Okay, let's just run through it for a moment. Just gotta raise your hands. Okay, the first question is: normal adolescent development is tumultuous. True or false? Let's see you raise your hands for true. And how many say false? Okay. I'm not going to tell the answers yet. Adolescence is a time of increased emotionality. True or false? True. Let me see your hands. And false. Number three, adolescents do not have an increased risk for suicide. True or false? It's a double negative. Adolescents do not have an increased risk for suicide. Let's see your hands for true. False. Okay. Number four. Puberty is a negative experience for adolescents. How many of you say that's true? How many of you say it's false? Number six, this is a loaded question. Most Jewish adolescents are academically average. Oh, I'm sorry. Adolescent thoughts are childlike. True? Raise your hand. Or false? Okay, here's a loaded one. Most Jewish adolescents are academically average. How many of you said true? And how many think that's false? All right. Substance abuse is not a problem amongst religious adolescent youth. True or false? How many say that's true? False. Let me see you raise your hands. Number eight, 20% of adolescents have mental health problems. True or false? True. Let's see your hands. False. And number nine, mental health problems are not as prevalent amongst Ashkenazi Jewish adolescents. True or false? Compared to the general population. And number 10, the main cause of mental illness amongst adolescents is a disruptive family. True or false? Is this true? And how many say it's false? All right. Now keep your eyes on your sheet and let's see how you've done. Psychiatrist by the name of Dan Offer, who was a professor of psychiatry at McMaster University and throughout the 1990s, did a large epidemiological study to look at the attitudes of normal adolescents. The study was done amongst thousands of adolescents throughout Canada and the United States. And he came to the following conclusions. Firstly, and surprisingly, normal adolescence is not tumultuous. Normal adolescence, when we talk about regular development and adolescence, it is not a tumultuous time. The second finding of this large epidemiological study was that normal adolescence is not a time of increased emotionality. It is not a time of increased emotionality. And puberty is not a negative experience. His fourth finding was that normal adolescence is not a time of increased suicidality. And he also concluded something very important, which many people had spoken about for a long period of time. And I think any of us who have adolescents know that adolescent thoughts are not childlike and adolescents are not children. But we'll come back to that in a moment. Now, there have been some other fascinating studies, large epidemiological studies, that have tried to get a broad picture, because when we live in our little world with our three or four or five or eight children, or we live in our community, we lose a kind of broader perspective of what the scope looks like across North America. Now, this is very surprising. In a study done by Duvon et al., he found, surprisingly, that most adolescents have positive feelings about their parents. That's not what you would get if you were to watch a television show or you listen to the popular media, but most adolescents really, in the end of the day, really feel okay about their parents. In fact, we find that it is the disturbed adolescent, the child who is going through difficult times, who will turn to his peers for the support, for the emotional support during their adolescence. Whereas, the large studies tell us that adjusted teenagers, do you know who they seek help from? From their mother and their father. In fact, I just saw a consultation recently of a mother and a father and a child, and the boy tells me that he has not spoken to his father in over a year, and his father was right there in the room. I haven't talked to Dad in a year. Huh? Why? I'm angry at him. Do you want to talk to your dad? And the tears started to come down. Yeah, I want to talk to my dad. I want my dad. I need my dad. Now let's think for a moment before we talk about the pathologies, before we talk about the stuff that goes wrong in adolescence, let's try to define for a moment what is adolescence and what is normal adolescence. I've already given you some ideas of what large studies tell us. And there have been different models of trying to understand child and adolescent development. Of course, we know Freud's work and we understand the drive theory behind Freud's analytical position. Winnicott and Bowlby, the psychosocial approach, looking at the child within the community. And the model of Piaget's model of looking at the age of 11 to adulthood as being the time of what he called his formal operations. It's the time when the child starts to say, what could be? Where the adolescent develops a kind of deductive and theoretical reasoning. Where the backbone of logical and scientific thoughts start. And where the child is very egocentric. Piaget understood the adolescent as being the one who fails to differentiate what others are thinking about and his or her own mental preoccupations. We all know Erik Erikson, and he talked about the life cycle and the stage 5 of adolescence, of identity versus role diffusion. The struggle of an adolescent to understand who she is, identifying and finding what he called their ego identity. And adolescence is a time when, yes, the kids will have a preoccupation with their appearance, hero worship, group identity. And normal adolescence is a time of normal confusion about sexuality, about my vocational identity, and about the development of ethics. But what we've come to know is that Freud's ideas about the development of the adolescent, or even the psychosocial understanding of the adolescent, is not enough. Because now we are asking and looking at the questions of nature versus nurture in a more sophisticated kind of way. Now, as Michael Rutter puts it, we're looking at the developmental psychobiology, at the genes of our children, and the gene-environment interplay. Really, when we think about the development of an individual, we need to think about all domains. The biological domain, the psychological domain, the social domain, and the genetic domain. Let me give you an example. This is an example of some pathology. Everybody here familiar with schizophrenia? By the way, does anyone know what the prevalence of schizophrenia would be? How common do you think schizophrenia is? Take a guess.
How common?
Out of 1,000 people, what would you expect? 20% of the population? That's a bit high. 20% of the population. That might explain some things. What? 3%? It's approximately around 1% of the population. Now let's take that famous case the monozygotic identical twins. I have identical twins. We take those twins and we separate them at birth. Neither twin is raised by their biological parent. Twin A is raised in New York by loving parents. And twin B is raised in California by loving parents. At the age of 17, twin A develops schizophrenia. What is the statistic? What is the concordance rate? What is the chance that his brother, whom he has never met, seen, raised in a different family, what is the chance that brother B in California will develop a schizophrenic illness raised by wonderful, caring, and sensitive parents? What do you say? 5%? 7%? If you're a doctor, you can't answer.
I think it should be high because it's inherited.
What do you say? What do you think it is? 50%? 90%? Very good. The 80% concordance rate. There's an 80% chance that twin B will develop a schizophrenic illness. We know that there are genes and there is a biological set which all of us have inside of us. We know diseases like Alzheimer's disease, where we're able to start to identify the genes, and we know that mental illness, learning disabilities, attentional problems are genetic issues. Most of our kids, thank God, don't have these disorders. And most of our kids are struggling with normal adolescents, and most of us as parents are struggling with raising normal adolescents. Richard Rousseau put it as follows. It's not an easy time for any parent, this moment, when the realization dawns that you've given birth to something that will never see things the way you do, despite the fact that it is your living legacy and that it bears your name. Because in its essence, adolescence is about the child finding their own unique identity with their genetic dispositions, with the influence that we give them in the families, but it's about finding and identifying themselves. Yes, normal adolescence is a time of struggle and looking for that identity. And it's influenced, as I said before, by biological factors, by psychological factors, by social factors, and by genetic factors. And most adolescents do just fine with good enough parenting. But Bernstein, in a large epidemiological study, found that 20% of adolescents will have significant emotional or psychiatric problems. 80% of the population is going to be fine, but 1 in 5, 20%, will have a psychiatric disorder. Now, what are these disorders? These disorders would include mood disorders, anxiety disorders, psychotic disorders, eating disorders, learning disorders, behavioral disturbances, personality disorders, and of course, substance abuse. Some of these problems start early on in life. Problems like oppositional defiant disorder, the kid who doesn't want to listen to anything you have to say, or a learning disorder early on in life, or attention deficit disorder. In fact, by its very definition, it must start early in childhood. Does anybody have an idea of what the statistics are of how many children have attention deficit disorder in the population? 4.1% of kids will have an attention deficit disorder, 2 to 3 times more common in girls than boys. Boys than girls. Ah, there you go. 2 to 3 times more common in boys than girls. In fact, what's just like heart disease, we discovered, has been underdiagnosed in women. Attention deficit disorder, you know, comes in two forms. There's attentional ADD, attention deficit disorder, which is primary, a difficulty with the child's ability to concentrate and to attend. And there's attention deficit hyperactivity, which is the wild child, wired and can't sit, who also has an attentional problem. Do you know what's very underreported and what becomes a very, very big problem is for the young, docile girl who is not a behavioral problem, who sits in class and everybody loves her, and yet she has an undiagnosed attention deficit disorder that's not discovered till she enters into junior high or into high school, and yet has suffered all of those years despite interventions with a significant attentional problem. Now, if you take a look at mental disorders, you'll find that many of them will start during middle and late adolescence. Let's talk for a moment about a major depressive disorder. Again, this is a syndrome, a major depressive disorder. It's not just someone feeling bad or someone feeling emotional or upset, but it's a syndrome of someone having a low mood for weeks on end. They're paralyzed, they're sleeping all the time, or they have disrupted sleep. There's been a change with their appetite. They are suicidal. They feel hopeless and worthless. What would you venture? What would you think? What's the lifetime prevalence of a major depressive disorder? What would you imagine? What percentage of the population in their lifetime will experience a true clinical depression? It depends on what you read, but anywhere from 14, up to close to 20% of people will experience a real clinical depression. 6.5 of women or girls during a period of lifetime, and 3.3 of men per year. That's that statistic. Eating disorders. Anorexia nervosa and bulimia. Do we know what that is? I mean, it's in the press everywhere, right? Anorexia, of course, is the young girl, primarily girl, who's going to restrict herself, right, from eating, who has a disturbed image of herself in the mirror, sees herself as being very, very heavy and overweight despite the reality. What's the prevalence, do you think, of anorexia in the general population? What would you say? No, it's not 30%. It's very popular. The magazines want to make you believe that's around 3.7%. And bulimia is around 4.2%. Dysthymic disorder, which is a chronic low mood. It's not a clinical depression. It's not a situation where your adolescent is isolated in their room, where they're not participating in school. It's kind of a functional depression. They're still operating. They're still part of society. They're able to function, but yet life, the way I describe it, it tastes like one big Diet Coke. That is, if you don't drink Diet Coke normally. It just doesn't have its taste, its zest to it. And that's around a 5.4% prevalence rate. Bipolar disorder, manic depression, which is a disorder where the child will experience not only protracted times of depression, but will also experience the opposite, which will be high levels of irritability and or euphoria, which will last for days on end with an abundant amount of energy, and the person can become so ill that they can actually experience a psychosis, is around 1.2%. And schizophrenia, as we said before, is around 1.1%. And anxiety disorders, which include panic disorder of 2.3 prevalence, or post-traumatic stress disorder, which is 3.6, or generalized anxiety disorder, or social phobia, or OCD, around 2% or 3% of the population. In all, 13.3% of individuals will develop an anxiety disorder, and these disorders, eating disorder, dysthymia, bipolar, schizophrenia, anxiety disorders, they will appear amongst the 20% that we talked about before, not the 80, but the 20% of the adolescents who are hitting a wall of some kind. This is when it's going to happen, in their mid to late adolescence. But again, I'm oversimplifying it because each disease has a specific onset, but we're looking at 17, 18, 19, 20, but that's on a bell curve, and you can see these disorders even found in children who are younger. And you can even find schizophrenia, for instance, in children, but it's quite rare, but you can find it in younger children. 90% of kids, or for that fact, of the general population, who will kill themselves will have a mental disorder, and most commonly it will be a depressive disorder or a substance abuse disorder, but 10 to 15% of kids who kill themselves do not kill themselves in the face of a major depression or a major psychiatric disorder. I'll never forget when I was doing emergency room at Sunnybrook, there was a young girl who came in. I was working with, I think Schwartz is one of the presenters here, I was working with Dr. Schwartz. He was my attending, and a young girl came in, And she was brought into the trauma area. And we didn't understand the circumstances at first. She kind of fell out of a window. And the long and short of it was is that she was paralyzed, going to be paralyzed from her waist down. And when she arose from her, she was somewhat comatose for a while. The doctor stood by her bed, and I don't know if it was the appropriate time or not, but he announced to her that she was never going to walk again. Now, the story was that this was a fairly well-adjusted adolescent who had an unfortunate circumstance and fight with her father that escalated to the point that she took a dramatic move and decided to jump out of the window, thinking that she was going to land into the bushes without any kind of consequence from her activity. But she was unfortunately paralyzed. And so yes, there are cases of suicide, which will be anywhere from 10 to 15% in the end of the day that will not be related to a mental disorder.
Why does it happen to certain people and certain kids not happen today?
Well, we're going to get to that, okay? I mean, it's a good question, but what I was trying to outline before is that there are many factors, not one factor, okay? There are a number of factors, including our family, including the society, including our biology and our genetics, including what happens to the child at school, the academic issues, substances. There's not one factor, there's not one easy answer, not one story. 4 times as men than women will complete suicide, but women attempt suicide and girls attempt suicide 2 to 3 times more often than boys do. And no, the incidence of suicide there's not a higher incidence of suicide during adolescence, but adolescents, thank God, are basically healthy children. So the third leading cause of death for a 15 to 24-year-old is a suicide, because they're not going to be dying usually of heart disease or Parkinson's or whatever. All right. I've thrown you some statistics. I've tried to give you a little bit of a view of the 20% of the pathology, but you're probably all saying to yourself, it doesn't happen in the Jewish community. Doctor, you are giving me broad statistics that are not relevant to our community, to my family, or to our lives. Well, Dr. Ann Pulver, Johns Hopkins University, doesn't seem to think so. In fact, Dr. Pulver has started a study which is looking at bipolar manic depression and schizophrenia amongst adolescents and young adults, because she has a hypothesis that it is probably twice as common in the Ashkenazi population than it is in the broader community. And so there's a large study right now that is looking at the Ashkenazi population. Dr. Leora Pinchas, who was a resident just a few years ahead of me at Sick Kids Hospital, has done a lot of work within the Jewish schools, both the Orthodox and the non-Orthodox Jewish schools, looking at eating disorders, and has also come up with some preliminary data that seemed to indicate that we might be having an increased amount of eating disorders in our community. Why are we dealing with the issues that we are confronted with? What is specific about our community? What kind of stresses exist in our community? Do you think that that might be reasons as to why eating disorders and other disorders might be more prevalent? Anybody have any idea?
Being different.
I'm sorry?
Being different. To be different from the others, we are different.
The pressure of a Jew's being different? Yeah?
Pressure to conform.
The pressure to conform? Okay. Any other pressures you think we have in our community? Yes?
I think the stresses among young women, especially to marry early, marry well.
Okay. Anybody, anyone else have any other ideas about why we might be dealing with this stuff more prevalent in our community? Any other kind of pressures that we have?
Pressures.
I'm sorry?
Academic pressures.
Academic pressures?
It's probably because percentage-wise, intelligence level is higher.
I'm sorry?
It's probably because percentage-wise, the intelligence level is higher than the
Okay, I don't know if that bears that, actually. If you've been to the University of Toronto recently and you sit in the classes with all the Chinese students, I don't know if we have that monopoly about being bright. We like to think so, but I'm not too sure.
The restrictions are more in the Jewish community than in the global pressure.
Yeah. Look, I don't think that we have, I think these are hypotheses. Some of the things that have been brought forward about the Ashkenazi Jewish community, as I've mentioned to you before, is that there is a strong genetic component to some of these disorders, right? And I think that there are lots of pressures and there are lots of expectations of our children. One of the questions I asked you, kind of half-jokingly, most of the stuff that I asked you was research, but this one wasn't, and that was, do you think that most Jewish children are academically average? Well, it's kind of a trick question, because by definition, most means average. And yet, what do we do when we have a child that doesn't exactly fit into that, that program that we have for them? And there are great social expectations of our kids. It doesn't matter what part of the Jewish community we're living in, we have expectations for our children, and if a child can't reach that, what happens to them? Now, the teaching several years ago about substance abuse amongst adolescents was that substance abuse is really less per capita in the Jewish community. That we have more exposure to alcohol, but the rate of alcoholism is lower. But if you look in a lot of anecdotal literature and you speak to clinicians on the ground, we are overwhelmed with the substances that our kids are taking, both marijuana and alcohol. Jewish children, marijuana. What's the big deal? It's just marijuana. In fact, there were four articles in the fall of 2002 in the British Journal of Medicine that talked about the deleterious effects of marijuana and how dangerous marijuana can be and the neurotoxic damage that could take place in the brain. And yet our Canadian government wants to legalize marijuana. What do we do if we think something is not going right with our adolescent? What do we do if we think that our kid might be falling in that 20%, in that 1 in 5 who needs some kind of help? Where do we start? Who do we go to? I'm just trying to figure this out, and I've been studying this for a number of years. I think if I was in your position, I would be totally lost. Where do I go? Let me share with you a story to kind of illustrate this. And the physicians remain silent. I saw a child in assessment, also probably around 2 months ago. It was a 15-year-old boy who had been diagnosed as having a conduct disorder. That's just a fancy word for being a difficult child. And they had come to Sunnybrook for a psychiatric assessment because the child was experiencing some bizarre kinds of thoughts, and they wanted to see what that was all about. Now, this family had been involved with the Jewish Family Children's Service. They had been involved with a number of social workers, with a number of psychologists over a number of years. And they had been from one family therapist to another family therapist, trying to find out, why was this kid so aberrant? Why were his behaviors escalating to the point that he was not listening to his parents despite any kind of interventions? What was going on with this child? And the parents were blamed. The father and the mother weren't together on their disciplining. The father and the mother had some conflicts with one another, but let me tell you a little bit more about the story. This child had episodes when he was a little kid where he was staring, and they didn't think much about it at all. In fact, when he was young, he used to wake up and scream and have terror dreams and scream in the middle of the night. They told their family doctor about it, didn't think much about it. He kept on having these staring episodes. He kept on having these episodes. I've talked to two neurologists here, but he kept on having these staring episodes and these episodes where he was screaming, waking up out of his sleep. Until finally, at age 13, and he kept on talking, by the way, about his teddy bear that was talking to him, and that he was hearing voices, and they just said it's a bunch of child play. And it's because mom and dad weren't together and they're disciplining, and they had to learn how to discipline the child a bit better. Until finally, at 14 years of age, the kid had a grand mal seizure. He had a seizure. And the diagnosis is the kid has seizure disorder. He had an undiagnosed seizure disorder from the time that he was a youngster, where he had these staring episodes, where he had the night terrors, where he had aberrant behavior and psychotic symptoms, where he was hearing things and seeing things, and yet the diagnosis did not become clear until he was 14 years of age. But can you imagine the parents who went from counselor to counselor to counselor, who made attributions of his child's behaviors because the parents were not good parents? Can you imagine how these parents were crying in my office when I told them that they had a child who had epilepsy and that the behaviors that they were watching were because he had a neurological disorder, and that I would write their own parents' notes to excuse them from what had been perceived as being poor parenting? So what do we do if we think our child has a problem? Well, the first thing we need to do is actually to go to our family doctor or go to our pediatrician. 99% of the time, the family doctor, the pediatrician is going to look at your kid and probably tell you it is not a medical problem, but you need to know that. You need to know that the thyroid is okay, that the kid doesn't have some other kind of medical condition or neurological condition or something else that might be responsible, especially if the behaviors have changed in an abrupt fashion. Especially if things have kind of been going along just fine, all of a sudden something's very strange. So if we're thinking about how do we go along the process, the first thing I would do would be to go to my family doctor or pediatrician to make sure I haven't missed anything, which is medical. So now I've decided it's not a medical condition. Well, do I get professional help or not? Well, what does my pediatrician say? What does my family doctor say? They see lots of children. Do they think? Listen to their advice. Important, is my child not functioning? Has it affected the functioning of the child? Is it something that is life-threatening? Is this child threatening to kill himself? Even though I'm second-guessing myself when he's saying that, I know he or she, I believe, doesn't really mean that. But if the child is saying that, it deserves at least a professional eye to see the child to make sure that it's not a suicidal thing. What's happening to the child in school? Are they functioning at school? And what is the school and what is the teacher saying? And do I see psychiatric symptoms? Is there isolation? Is there a lot of avoidance behavior? Is the child disorganized? Has my daughter lost a lot of weight and very preoccupied with how she's looking? And then what do? I decide, yes, he or she needs some professional help. But which professional? What kind of professional? And that's the answer. First of all, it has to be a professional. And one of the problems with our discipline is that it's not regulated. Anybody can put a sign up in their door and tell you that they are therapists. Well, what's their credentialing? Where do they go to school? Do they belong to some kind of professional body? What's their expertise? And I'll give you something to think about. When you see those advertisements and they tell you that they can deal with all children, with all problems, of all ages, and they can do it miraculously, within a few weeks, then you can also believe that they can grow hair out of their palm and they can sell you a bridge in Brooklyn. And you should be weary of someone who tells you that they have all of the answers. So let's look for a professional and let's make sure that the professional, in fact, has their credentialing. But then the question is, what kind of professional? Do I go to a social worker? Do I go to a psychiatrist? Do I go to a psychologist? And the truth of the matter is that any one of these licensed individuals would be a good starting point, even though it might not be the correct starting point, because a good clinician, a good professional, will be able to say, this is not my area, but this is where you ought to go. However, if there are certain kinds of things that you're worried about with your adolescent, then it might direct your thinking in terms of what my initial intervention should be. For instance, if it is life-threatening, if the child is doing some kind of aberrant behavior, cutting themselves, mutilating themselves, or threatening suicide, then in all likelihood, the best place to initially go is to go to a psychiatrist who is in association with a hospital, because if a child like this may or may not need hospitalization, and your average clinician in the community will not be able to deal with that. Does the child have a disorder like schizophrenia? Am I worried because there's a family history of schizophrenia or bipolar disorder? And when I'm looking at the moods in my child, they're quite dramatic, then I'm thinking about going to a psychiatrist. But if the child has educational issues, if it's the child's having difficulty in school, and the issues are primarily academic, even though they will spill over into all kinds of other problems, then the right person is not to take them to a psychiatrist, but they need to go to an educational psychologist to get an appropriate academic assessment. And if we're looking at good counseling and good family work and understanding the dynamics, this is a strength of many, many social workers. So we need to try to understand what the issues are with our child, with the help of professionals, our family doctor and our pediatrician, and then trying to guide them into the appropriate, into the right place. I'm going to just end with a story, and then I'm going to open up for questions for a few moments. But when I was around 19 or 20, I was in yeshiva in Baltimore, and I remember reading a book by Dr. Tursky, Rabbi Dr. Tursky, fairly well-known individual. And this was one of his secular books. He's a Hasidic rabbi who's a psychiatrist and especially a substance abuse. And in this book, he doesn't mention anywhere whatsoever that he is a rabbi. And he talks about the story where he walks into a room and he meets a woman who's 40 years of age, and he attempts to engage her in a psychiatric assessment, but realizes after a moment or two that she's nonsensical and she really can't engage her. She's quite disorganized. And her story was that at 13 or 14 years of age, she just started to use some substances, starting with some alcohol and just marijuana, eventually started to use other substances, and now the sequelae, 30 years down the road, where she had done enough brain damage with herself that she couldn't carry on a normal conversation. So Tursky at that point says he's a rabbi. He says, I'm a rabbi. He says, when I saw this child, he said, I had a theological question. He said, how could it be that God could create a world where the greatest choices in the world, the entire trajectory and the future of your life, is going to be in the hands of a 13 or 14 or 15-year-old? How could it be? And he leaves that as a question. How could it be that the greatest choices, that the entire trajectory and future of my life will be in the hands of a 14 or 15 or 16-year-old? But we as parents are the guardians of those adolescents. And most of the time, our good enough parenting is going to be good enough. But to try to keep our eyes open for these kinds of things that I describe, for the isolations, for the changes of behavior, for the erratic behavior, for the mood difficulties, for a child who is abruptly changed with regards to their presentations, these are the things that will need our kinds of interventions, that we should be taking children to professionals and then entering them, engaging on a process to get them the help that they need, because there is good help. And when the diagnosis is the proper diagnosis and the proper treatments, whether they be psychological treatments, whether they be family treatments, or whether they be treatments with medication, and that's a whole controversial area, which I'm sure we can open and talk about, but whatever it is, to identify them, to get my child help at the appropriate time, will help them negotiate this not tumultuous but very challenging time of adolescence. So thank you for engaging me in this discussion with you, but I actually would like to hear some questions from you. Yes?
Doctor, you outlined a study that said adolescence is not tumultuous.
Yes.
I think we need to define tumultuous, because I think most of us who parent adolescents sense that there is something going on that's within the range of normal. And if we take out the word tumultuous, then we all have to go to psychiatrists and psychologists, etc. So could we define what is within the realm of normal for a teenager as they're discovering their independence and breaking away from their parents, which is something we want them to do?
That's right. That's what it's all about. It's about a kid in a healthy kind of way separating and doing their... And finding themselves during that period of time. Again, when there are psychiatric symptoms like isolation, like depression, like eating disorder, right? Then obviously this kind of child needs help.
Maybe could you define isolation? Because I have have 16 teenagers, one just turned 20, but there are times when all of them close themselves in their room, and they don't want to have anything to do with the family, and they're totally okay, I thought.
Right.
Well, according to this definition, that's not normal.
Well, again, I mean, you know, I think we're looking at a prevalent pattern of what's going on with the child. If a child comes home and he's in a bad mood and he doesn't have the ability to negotiate that, like presumably you and I do, and he isolates himself in the room for a half an hour, 45 minutes, I wouldn't say I have to go call a psychiatrist the next day. But if you're seeing that a child is in their room for days and days on end and weeks on end, that's going to become a concern. One of the issues, and actually Jeremy and I are going to deal with that in the next session, but is that when parents actually don't allow what needs to happen and the intervention is too strong on behalf of the parent, because then you can actually iatrogenically cause problems. In other words, you have to respect the fact that the kid wants his own privacy, that he's going to start to do his or her own thing. And when there's too much intrusion in what's happening there, when there's too much concern, right, and too much involvement, too much control, then you're going to create a situation that the kid's going to want to rebel and find their own space. Yeah, I mean that's a good question, because I see a very skewed population, because I see them by the time they've ended up in a psychiatric office, or I've seen them in the emergency room because the justice of the peace or the family doctor or pediatrician has placed a form on the child and has forced them to come in for help.
But if it hasn't got that far,
right,
to the point where you feel you want to deal with it before it does get too far. Yes.
Well, I mean, look, first of all, I think that families need coaching. And the mother and the father, oftentimes, if the child will not gauge in any kind of help, the mother and the father will want to use the help of a professional, of a social worker, a psychologist, psychiatrist, whomever, to understand what the dynamic is in the home and how I can, over time, try to bring that kid within the process. But if it becomes a situation where it is urgent or emergent, i.e. life-threatening, then there are things that you're able to do against the child's will. And you're right, it's not something we want to do, but it's a position, unfortunately, that parents are faced with. Under those circumstances, if you take the child to any pediatrician or family doctor and there's concern about a life-threatening or imminent life-threatening problem, they can force them by putting them on a form to come to see a doctor. Or you can actually go before the justice of the peace and argue your concern, and they can actually issue a form that a child can be brought in to a psychiatrist. But you're right, that's a very dramatic situation, one that I see frequently because I deal with a very skewed population. But I think that the idea of engaging in a process, and even if the kid doesn't want to do it, but engaging in a family in the context of doing some family work would be a good place to start. Yeah.
You asked us a question, but you didn't really answer it. And that was, why does the Jewish population have a higher than normal percentage of mental health problems? And everybody sort of gave their theories, but you didn't really answer.
Well, I did. I acknowledge the fact that I don't think that there are a lot of clear-cut answers. I don't want you to leave here with the impression that we have more mental disorders across the board than the general population. What I did say to you was that with schizophrenia and bipolar, it's probably higher, and there's probably a genetic reason as to why those two disorders are higher. I did tell you that eating disorders may be higher, but I don't have that statistic, and wondered about some of the social pressures, but I don't think we have a clear answer, you know, as to why that's the case. I wanted to leave here today with the idea, not that our society is sicker than the rest of the society, but I'm trying to break a myth, which is we don't have problems in our community. Yes, we have problems in our community, and they need to be dealt with like any other society presumably is dealing with their children.
You give us statistics about the situation with the kids, but I would like to understand that actually in the end of this session that we are going to have kind of guideline how to behave in order to avoid this statistic that you describe. What kind of behavior? I mean, I'm talking about milestone reaction that we as a parent has to put into this factor, into this formula, so it won't come to this situation. I don't care that there is 20%. I want to know how to behave in order to avoid it.
Yes. Well, I think that there are times that there might be interventions that we can do, but there are also times where, despite our interventions, it might be inevitable that your kid's going to run into some problems.
Not in any case, no.
I think that, for instance, let me give you one typical scenario, and this kind of bears itself out in the literature. When you deal with a lot of kids who end up acting out and feeling very marginalized and end up using substances, which causes their own kinds of problems, oftentimes, if you take a look retrospectively, you look back at this child's history, you will see that the child was marginalized already within the school system, that the child was having difficulties, academic difficulties. If you take a look at children who develop conduct disorder or substance abuse, there's a disproportionate amount of children who have educational problems, who have learning disabilities that have been undiagnosed, who have attention deficit disorder, which has been undiagnosed. And this child becomes frustrated and more frustrated. The parent becomes frustrated in dealing with the child, not understanding what's happening with them. The child feels marginalized within the system, and therefore becomes a marginalized member of society and finds behaviors that are kind of aberrant during their early and the middle adolescence. And that's a problem that has its origins going back early on within the family context. Yes.
For example, a policeman, in his behavior, he can be a criminal, but you know how to track him, actually, to take his violent, his all dynamic behavior towards the good and not towards the bad. So we as the parents, maybe he has some characters, but we have to direct him to put this his all energy into the developing himself and not destroying himself.
Right.
We as the parents have this rule, and I want to know how we have to guide ourselves or tell ourselves this is what we have to tell or guide the kids to do.
Right. This is not a painting by numbers story. It's a complex situation. I'm not trying to avoid you, but it's hard to, you know, answer your specific problem. What I'm saying is we need to identify these academic issues that are happening with the children. We need to identify what's happening early on in school. We need to identify what's happening within the context of the family. Where's the peace in the family? What's happening between mother and father? These are all issues that we know will bear down on the child, and that the child, as they go through their adolescence, will put them at increased risk. So if you want to go home and say, what do I need to do? One thing I need to do is I need to make sure, again, that this is not all about the family, but I need to make sure that things are intact with the family. Oftentimes what happens, and this is family theory, and Jeremy's a family therapist, could talk about this more, but oftentimes the child is presented to the therapist as the problem. This is my child who is anxious. This is my child who is oppositional. This is my child who is using drugs. He's the problem. But when you start to work with the family, you understand that the dynamic within the family system, right, has been at least partially contributing to this child's behavior, and that the discord that can exist between mom and dad, right, are issues that need to be that would need to be addressed. Okay, you have 3 minutes. Okay, any last questions? Yes. Yeah, it's a serious problem. The system, the you know, in one way, we have a wonderful system in Canada because everyone gets free access to health care. However, you get delayed free access to health care. If you try to see a psychiatrist, for instance, it'll take you a year to get an appointment with a psychiatrist. If you go through Sunnybrook, it probably takes... Yeah, it's terrible, but this is the reality. This is the reality of the system. I'll tell you some secrets, though. Okay, some secrets are. I often saw this when I was a resident at SickKids. If you're really desperate about your kid, and you've tried to access care, and you've looked at allied health professionals, but you don't feel for whatever reason that this is an area of their domain, then take the kid to the emergency room. Okay, and if you take the child to the emergency room, then the onus of the responsibility now becomes that resident and that on-call doctor. So it's a way of accessing the system. Just don't use my name, okay? but it is a way. But I'm sorry?
It's on the table.
But it is, you're right, this is a very, very unfortunate thing, and it's the reality, but I don't think we can rely on MDs. I think there are many problems that are dealt with far better by other professionals. Eating disorder programs, however, you need to get into SickKids hospital, and it's virtually impossible to get into SickKids. Do you know that by the time the kid gets into SickKids, you know what the criteria is? They are cardiovascular unstable. They have to be on a cardiac monitor. That is when we were accessing the care. And by the way, Derek Agav, I will tell you, that when I was doing my rotation at SickKids, I had times where there were, at the time, there were eight beds where all eight kids were Jewish. All eight kids were Jewish in that program from the Jewish day schools and the like. So it is a very difficult thing, but again, I go back to my pediatrician, back to my family doctor, using them as advocates. I'd also explore the social worker and the psychologist, and not just wait for medical care. Because what's also disappointing about medical care is, at the end of the day, you've waited 1 year for this assessment, and you go and you see the psychiatrist, and they'll see you for that magical period of time. They'll give you their magical diagnosis, and they'll tell you, be on your way, right? So, you know, there are serious problems with our system. Granted. Anyway, thank you very much for your interest.